Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Page 57, Sutra 39. In the observation of devotional cultivation, if the renunciation is not properly followed, the ultimate bhakti is not attained, although the aspirant is safeguarded from downfall. Unless the body, mind, and senses are controlled by the help of theistic knowledge and proper renunciation, the observation of devotional cultivation cannot provide any upliftment. The only gain of such practice is that it will guard the aspirant from downfall. In Bhagavad Gita 6:40, the Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, O son of Pita, a transcendentalist engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction either in this world or in the spiritual world. One who does good, my friend, is never overcome by evil. So he's not overcome, but he doesn't necessarily get to the transcendental platform. But the point is that the devotional service will not be lost. That's always the basic principle. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Mantra 3, in the Bhagavad Gita 6:41-43, it is stated that a man who enters upon the path of self-realization but does not complete the process, despite having sincerely tried to realize his relationship with God, is given a chance to appear in the family of Suci, or Srimat. The word Suci indicates a spiritually advanced Brahmana, and Srimat indicates a Vaishya, a member of the mercantile community. So the person who fails to achieve self-realization is given a better chance in his next life, due to sincere efforts in this life. If even a fallen candidate is given a chance to take birth in a respectable and noble family, one can hardly imagine the status of one who has achieved success. By simply attempting to realize God, one is guaranteed birth in a wealthy or aristocratic family. But those who do not even make an attempt, who want to be covered by illusion, who are too materialistic and too attached to material enjoyment, must enter into the darkest regions of hell, as confirmed throughout the Vedic literature. Such materialistic asuras sometimes make a show of religion, but their ultimate aim is material prosperity. The Bhagavad Gita 16:17-18 rebukes such men, calling them atma sambhavita, meaning they are considered great only on the strength of deception and are empowered by the votes of the ignorant and by their own material wealth. Such asuras, devoid of self-realization and knowledge of Ishavasya, the Lord's universal proprietorship, are certain to enter into the darkest regions. So they're attempting for material, but with so much great difficulty they're getting anything. But the devotee, because being distracted by material desires, he automatically gets all kinds of material facility. So what the karmi is laboring very hard for, the devotee gets very easily. Right? So, yes.
So it says, Brahmana family or Vaishya family, Kshatriya family?
A little farther down it mentions that. Or in a respectable and noble family.
Okay.
Because the general thing is, you know, that may also be there, because that would be something in between. But then you would, how do you say, much of the time, if you think about it, devotee is, you know,
nicely engaged in, you know, the different rituals and things like that, but may not be so dynamic, right? So that naturally would give rise to the brahminical birth. Or there's material desires and facilities that he's looking for, right? So the Vaishya family, then that's, you know, facility is there and there's minimal restrictions, right? How often do you meet someone who is materially, you know, gets materially distracted, but it's on the basis of noble and good qualities, right? Yeah. So therefore, Brahman or Vaishya, like that. If you have it, then of course nobility. But there's, you know, does that make sense? You know, in other words, you're going to end up where you're distracted from. You know, that's all. Attainment of relief from major sins like falsehood, intoxication, voluptuary, laziness, greed, disparaging, trespassing the superiors, idling, deceiving, breach of duty towards parents, treason, evil company in the guise of dance and music, ignorance, egotism, etc. is called retraction. So retraction means pulling back from all these things. So falsehood, you know, gambling, intoxication, voluptuary, illicit sex. So all these different things, pulling back from these things, then we see that's retraction. So then these things start to come very easily. Yes?
Maharaj, what is the breach of duty towards parents?
Breach of duty towards parents. So that the parents take care of you, so that you have a duty towards them.
Does that make sense? The word breach.
Breach. Breach means that a breach means there's a break or there's something. It's not happening. A gap, yeah.
So does it mean not taking care of the parents when they're
basically involved? Yes. Like that. It means if one is materially involved, one has the facility, then why wouldn't one take care of the parents? You know what I'm saying? If one is doing full-time service and things like that, then you're already taking care by, they'll get benefit from that. You know what I'm saying? So in either way, they're going to get benefit. Right? By being fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, then they're taken care of. Or if one's materially involved, then you're taking care of them.
And what if they are not favorable towards the devotional service? Like they don't like if the son practices the devotional service at home, does it mean that he has to leave the home? Or?
It depends. It means if they won't work, then he goes somewhere else. But the main point is if they want to interact, then they have to accept. You know, otherwise, you know, being alone is pretty standard. So if that's what they like, hey, go for it. Although the tendency for sins is not inherent with the constitution of the jivas, since they have gained ground in the hearts of the jivas since time immemorial, they act like the natural character of the jivas. Right? So these bad qualities aren't inherent in the jiva, but because they've been involved with them since time immemorial, then it becomes natural on the material platform. Though it's not the natural position like that. When these unnatural habits are subdued by regular practice, this will help the aspirant to discover the intrinsic nature of the jiva. So when one pulls back from this seeming material, natural way of behaving, then one is able to establish the actual internal nature of the jiva. Right? One is able to understand that, appreciate that. Everyone should keep a thorough list of all these sinful habits. Okay. So should keep a list, keep it there, keep checking. Not quite yet. Or we could make a special desktop thing for the devotees that has all those things with little checks on it. Yeah, but you always have to walk out about deceiving, right? Because you may say, yeah, no, I've gone, they're all gone. Yeah, like that, you know, deceiving. But deceiving's not checked yet. Everything else is. Right?
It's practical. It helps to remain humble.
Yeah, well, if you look at it, then it's like a matter of, okay, yeah. When a particular evil habit is brought under control, the attention should be given to the rest. Right? You know, practical. You have all these, and when one comes to control, now focus on the others. Not, okay, this done, hurry, well, let's have a party, right? You know. Many people are unable to avoid their sinful tendencies, even by being aware of them, because of the lack of proper effort in controlling them. Of course, at the time of controlling the sins in the prescribed manner, one should also pay due regard for the devotional cultivation. Otherwise, everything will end up in dry asceticism. Right? So in other words, when one of these qualities comes up, then one tries to control them. But one shouldn't forget about the reason for controlling. That's to please Krishna. Right? Otherwise, then it'll just become very dry. You know, it'll either be very hard because it's dry, or one will become dry and would think that that is very nice, so one will lose out on the taste of Krishna consciousness. So they have to go together. Right? Yes.
When it says, when a particular evil habit is brought under control, the attention should be given to the rest. Does that entail that basically you fight them one at a time?
I will, generally one comes up at a time, so you fight, and then if that one's not a problem anymore, then the attention goes on the other. You know, because when something's there, then it becomes prominent. In other words, anything that's more prominent, then you'll deal with that. When that goes, then you'll take the next one.
And what is the proper effort in controlling that?
Proper effort is they're not applying the shastric directions or taking advantage of association. It means, in other words, there's a recommended ways of viewing, you know, approaching it, so one can see how it's not useful in Krishna consciousness, or what of it is connected to Krishna, so it's not the material. So either it's not pleasing to Krishna as a person, or it's actually Krishna that you're looking for in this thing, and so why would you look in this indirect way when you can deal directly? So any of these, you know, by not being engaged in it, you know, so the senses become regulated.
When we become overwhelmed, then it's basically too late. So the practice is to...
The practice is whenever you can apply it. You practice whenever you can. Does that make sense? If you're overwhelmed by it, you can't practice it. So when you're not overwhelmed by it, you practice. You know what I'm saying? And then slowly, slowly, the practice will become established, or when the tendency to become overwhelmed will become less and less. Does that make sense? So it takes time. That's why he's saying, if one doesn't complete the process, then suchi shrimat, right? You know. So, but the point is that the holy name is so powerful that in one lifetime one can complete it. It's just if one focuses, then generally it will work. But if one gets distracted and one is comfortable in that distracted state, then, depending upon it's more just the mode of goodness or more, you know, facility for enjoyment, that is the distraction, then that gives rise to the next life.
So. What about devotees, Maharaj, who practice for a few years and they go way out there and basically for the rest of their lives they do not come back?
Are you saying they may not come back? Do you know any? You know what I'm saying? Most that I know, they go way out there, and then somehow they're way out there, it's not very good, and so then they come back. You know? Generally 10 years, if they're really serious, sometimes 20. But they're back.
But there are devotees, I think we've never seen.
Maybe, but we're thinking about it. So don't worry about the ones you don't know about. Worry about the ones that you do. You know, because you can't.
Let's say a devotee.
The point is if one takes up for some time and then gets so seriously distracted, then he goes to the heavenly planets. After that, then they come back and take birth in these kind of families.
So the one who's simply distracted by the, you know, the facilities and things, and but is still practicing the sadhana, then those don't go to the heavenly planet. They simply take birth.
If they're nicely fixed, then they generally take birth in devotee families. But then it may be also, then more facility, or, you know, if Krishna wants to correct it, then less facility. But the point is that it just depends upon how serious, because here it's pointing out there is no renunciation. Fails in the practice of renunciation. So generally, then they'll go through that process. They'll be born into these families. Those who are better at renunciation, but, you know, get distracted by that or something, they're generally in the family of devotees.
But generally, so we go to the heavenly planet before that happens?
If one's in, basically like this, if one's a neophyte, one goes to the heavenly planet. If one's a madhyama, one takes birth in the family of devotees. That's generally how it would work. Like that. That's why it's such a waste if those born in families of devotees and they worry about their material education and making it in the world. Because if that was the purpose, Krishna's smart enough to know to put him in another family, but that's not their purpose. You understand? So other than raising and feeding an animal, the parents would get no benefit. You know, I mean, other than what the animals get for raising kids. You know what I'm saying? So if the parents are trying to make them Krishna conscious from that, but if they're individuals, they take it, then they get, but the parents have made the attempt. But if the parents think, no, being material situated is all I have to do as a parent, yes, as an animal, that's all you have to do for, you know, the younger animal. But if you claim to be a devotee, then there's more there. Otherwise, what's the meaning? That's the more direct side. Does that make sense? So in other words, it's not a joke becoming a parent of devotees. It's a serious responsibility to do your best to make them into devotees. And you only get credit for that when they're 16 and they've chosen devotional service. Before that, you don't get the credit of having raised a devotee. Because they're not responsible for their own life. At 16, they're adult. They make that choice. Then you get the credit. Yeah, so that means 16 years. Now, if you spent that many hours preaching, how many people would you make committed to Krishna consciousness? You understand? 16 years and how many hours a day?
At least 3 or 4.
At least, yeah. If not hundreds, you know, a whole center, right? You know what I'm saying? So, in other words, it's only for the purpose of removing our own material distraction that's there from the need for family life that it has that value. And so because we have that, on top of that, then one can help train devotees. So Krishna arranges it that it comes out very nicely. It's a win-win situation. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, Lord Chaitanya and the Gaudiyas have no problem, or any of the Vaishnavas, with family, the concept, because in that, they're going to work out their material problems and they're going to raise Krishna conscious, you know, children. So it works out very nicely. But as we see here in the discussion, it's not that it's just all, you know, happy and sing a song and, you know, hold hands and dance around and it's accomplished. No, it's work. So unless that commitment is there, it won't be accomplished. Right? So those parents who just think, you know, the kids are healthy in that, they got a good education, now they're set up for the future, they've missed the whole point of being a parent. You know, the point is it's not proper to be born in the material world. We're supposed to go back to Godhead. It's a problem that you're born in the first place. So, since you're going to be born in a devotee family of devotees so that you can start off ahead. Does that make sense? That's the point of it. But if it's just you're going to be like any other parent, then you know, what's the specialness? Does that make sense? So the point is one gets what one's looking for, but at the same time, one is able to connect it to Krishna. Does that make sense? Like that. But if one doesn't have that conscious effort that one's trying to do that, then one won't get that benefit. You know what I'm saying? The indirect requires that you're aware of it. You chant the holy name, you're not aware of it, you still get benefit. Like that. But the indirect, unless there is that element of renunciation or connecting it to Krishna, there is no advancement. Like that. You know, it's simple. It's not rocket science here. You know, it's just, this is the way it is. Right? So there's the encouraging side, and then there's the, you know, just the scary side. So the point is, the just fact. So one looks at the scary side, one tries to avoid that, then it takes up the encouraging side and then, you know, gives one's effort there. Does that work? There are many people who don't follow the method of attraction but display symptoms of advanced devotees. Such symptoms are not the real signs of divine love, because worldly lust cannot remain within a person who has developed genuine devotional sentiments and divine love. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1.3.43, 1.3.46, and 1.3.54, Srila Rupa Goswami explains, even ordinary devotees cannot have such pure attachment for Krishna. Therefore, how is it possible for success to be achieved by persons whose hearts are contaminated by the actions and reactions of fruitive activities, and who are entangled by various types of mental speculation? Sometimes it is found that a person actually attached to material enjoyment or salvation has the good fortune to associate with pure devotees while they are engaged in chanting the holy name of the Lord. By the good grace of the Lord, one may also cooperate and join in the chanting. At that time, simply by the association of such pure devotees, the moonlike rays from their hearts reflect on him, and by the influence of the pure devotees, he may show some likeness of attachment caused by inquisitiveness. One commits offenses at the lotus feet of a devotee. One's shadow attachment or para attachment can be extinguished. This extinguishing is like the waning of the full moon, which gradually decreases and at last becomes dark. The conclusion is that everyone should practice retraction. Unless retraction is accepted as a constant companion of devotional service, the divine love will not be manifested. Hence the following sutra. So, because divine love means the inherent love of the living entity is directed in its natural state towards Krishna. Right? But if that's directed materially, it comes out as all these other qualities. Right? What we were saying before. You know how you say it. Falsehood, you think that it means you're attached to gain that will come. You know, so you think that, so it comes out by, through applying the concept of gain through not working. Right? So when you want gain but you're lazy, then it comes out as falsehood. Right? So that means your love for gain is there, but it's not like greed where the man is willing to work hard. But here is that you're not willing to work hard, you're lazy. Right? So one's in passion and one's in ignorance. So therefore it comes out as falsehood. Right? You know, intoxication, you're attached to everything's very nice, but you're not able to work for it, you're not able to act in the proper way. So therefore the situations come up, they're not nice. So that attachment, you understand? So in other words, the love, the inherent love of the jiva is being applied into these various ways, and so they come out as these qualities. So the point is the divine love won't manifest if these are being manifest, because it's the same love being directed in a different way. Right? Does that make sense? If the milk is being used to make sandesh, it's not going to make burfi. You can only do one or the other. Right? So to that degree that it's not, it's been retracted from its misapplication in the material, to that degree it can be applied into the spiritual. So this is not a 100% zero. This is by how much you're pulling out and applying into the spiritual, that much it's developing that way. But his point is the divine love means it's full, means prema is not going to happen until it's completely removed. The retraction is complete. Right? But it doesn't mean one doesn't advance, but he has brought out these elements of, you know, this top levels of advancement. So then in comparison to that, that's what we're taking as our goal. So prema is the goal, not just, you know, how you say, I got my rounds done without having to run off and do email or something. You know, it's like, you know, there, that was serious retraction.
Yeah.
You understand? So that's a good step, you know. So then, you know, and then slowly, then, you know. Okay. Conclusion is that everyone should practice retraction. Right? Practice means you're trying. It doesn't mean it's perfect, but you're trying. Unless retraction is accepted as a constant companion of devotional practices, right, the divine love will not be manifest. It's accepted. It doesn't mean that you're perfect at it. But you've accepted that they go together. That I'm trying to cultivate attachment to Krishna and detachment from the material energy. They go together. But sometimes, you hear devotees don't want to hear about detachment and renunciation and, you know, all these things. They're too painful. No, we don't want to hear all that. We just want to hear that whatever situation you're in, it's great, and you just be Krishna conscious, and everything is lovey-dovey and wonderful and everything like that. So that's nice, but the point is that how are you going to add Krishna more to your life if there's no space for Krishna? That's the point. So that's why it's part of it. It naturally comes. But the point is as you advance, that taste is there, so naturally one doesn't mind giving up. If one's just giving up and not developing the taste, then it's more difficult. Right? That's why then intelligence is important, because you can do something by intelligence, even though the mind is not overly enthusiastic. You know it's right, so the mind has that affinity to doing what's right. So therefore, you're doing it. But the result has not come. But then you'll become steady. And by becoming steady, then the taste comes. Does that make sense? But otherwise, one's generally giving up because there's something nicer. Krishna says you give up the lower because of a higher. Right? So the higher is that attraction to Krishna. Is that?
So it's a question of discrimination.
Question of discrimination. Yes, means you have to. Means it's discrimination. Yes, the choice and just, you know, what are you dealing with? You know, it's like Maya's here. She's offering this, and I always, like an idiot, take it. Yes. But the point is as soon as that course is finished, then I always think this is stupid, right? And then there's a whole list of reasons that it's not good, right? So now if you contemplate why that's not good, then she may trick again and again, because first she does this cover, right? Then she throws. Because when you throw, that's when you suffer, but you're already covered, so you don't notice it until you hit the bottom, right? You know, falling through the air seems very nice and light and free and all that. It's when you hit the pavement, that's when the problem comes, right? Then it gets a little sore, right? So the point is by contemplating and making that endeavor, after a while, then the intelligence starts to work when she's trying to cover. Then you can see, no, but if I do all this, then this will happen. And then you're saying this while she's covering you and throws you again. Right? And then you keep at it more, and then after a while, then it's like, you just go, no, it's not worth it. There's no benefit. What am I going to get? Every time you try that, it ends up in this problem. Right? Even if it seems nice in the beginning, she'll get you at the end. Right? Does that make sense? Chanting removes all problems. Right? Yeah. So, if you have a doubt that you'll be happy, she may give something nice at the beginning, but as soon as you've accepted that and relaxed, then she'll give you the trouble. Yeah. But then you understand, that's how it works. Right? So then one starts to give. So, but the point is that's the understanding. What's going to fuel that? The fueling that will be that determination to be absorbed in Krishna, positive activities of Krishna consciousness. Right? Does that make sense?
When we say to fight against Maya, is to fight against his qualities that we have.
Yes, to fight against his qualities, because these qualities are the natural inherent love that the living entity has, but being misapplied into the material nature. So that's what they give. Falsehood will give trouble later, because you may get away with it today, but tomorrow it'll catch you. Intoxication, eventually you have to wake up or run out of money, right? The voluptuary. No, these are
adjective. It's not an adjective. It should be a noun.
Not necessarily. Voluptuary means it's an attitude that you have. An attachment for the masculine and feminine interaction. You know, saying that's so it can't. Because there's a lot of applications that the words are correct, just people don't use them anymore. They haven't, you know. In other words, technically speaking, any word can have all the different applications of noun and verb and adjective and all these different things, but just people don't use them. You know, in Sanskrit, you can take it and move it around wherever you like. You know, many languages you can, but in English, technically it's there, but if people don't use it, they say you can't do that. They'll say it's not in the dictionary, but it doesn't really matter. The dictionary doesn't set the standard. This dictionary documents what standard's going on today. You know, that's all. Okay, so then all these different elements just means where the love has been distorted into. Right? So by intelligence you understand that it's not there, and the connection to Krishna. You want to please Krishna. You understand these elements that we were talking before about the Brahman, how it's actually Krishna that you're looking for. It's not the dead matter. So all these different aspects there. But at the same time, it's a positive. So what's the positive? To absorb yourself in hearing, chanting. That gives you more strength, then these things become less interesting, right? So if you want to increase the retraction, then one should try to increase one's attraction, right? By hearing and chanting, associating all these things more. That will then that combination is quite good. Yeah.
Yes. Somebody asked a question the other day. And they said something about like being bewildered or not very inspired or something like that. And you said you don't need to worry because in the later stages, these things like associating with devotees and, you know, taste for chanting, they're all present. They're all also present in the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness.
Yeah.
So all the way through, and my mind just caught that. I was like, great, you know, it's not so impossible, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So it was like the prayojan and the goal was very clear. So my question is, how can we learn how to get that, find the prayojana again? Because we've heard back to Godhead, the mind's like yada yada. I heard all this, but that caught it, and then it became inspired again.
Yeah.
So how do we learn how to do that for ourselves?
It's by association. It comes by association. It means here we're associating with the acharyas, right? Here then Vyasadeva is speaking, Srila Prabhupada is speaking, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is speaking, other acharyas are speaking. So by that association, then one gets that inspiration, because they are on an advanced level, you know, or on a perfect, it means they're on a perfect level, but they take the position of being on a, you know, something that's within our understanding. Right? So by that association, then we see. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So this, okay. So Sutra 40. pratyahara samridhya sadhanam bhavas tataiva bhavat prema. With the proper development of renunciation, one attains active devotional service, sadhana, then ecstasy, bhava, and finally pure love, prema, for the Lord. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. By regular practice, one makes advancement in renunciation and devotional service. First, there is active devotional service, sadhana, then ecstasy, bhava, and finally pure love, prema, for the Lord. Thus, with the proper development of renunciation, one makes advancement in devotional service, culminating in ecstasy and pure devotional love. To what extent the retraction is followed, the aspirant attains a purity to the same proportion. Depending on the stage of purification, to the same degree the spiritual form of the Lord is revealed to the devotee. The Supreme Personality of Godhead explains, Bhagavad Gita 9.9, follow the regulative principles of bhakti yoga. In this way, you'll develop a desire to attain me. In bhakti rasa, In bhakti rasamrita sindhu 1212, 1 through 2, Srila Rupa Goswami explains, there are the three categories of devotional service are: 1, devotional service in practice, sadhana; 2, devotional service in ecstasy, bhava; and 3, devotional service in pure love of Godhead, prema. When we wish to develop our innate capacity for devotional service, there are certain processes which, by accepting and executing them, will cause that dormant capacity to be invoked. Such practice is called sadhana bhakti. Right. So Krishna is pointing out, you follow the regulative principles. The regulative principles are to see that retraction is going on, and that the regulated practice of attraction to Krishna is going on. In other words, what is the direct activities of the devotional service, and then how those things that are distracting, they're either dropped or engaged in the Lord's service. Right? Then, naturally, then all these things will be revealed. Right? So the attraction, one gains purity. Depending on purity, then one understands the form of the Lord. So that's why he's putting so much emphasis on this, right? But from that, because he's gone through such great difficulty to explain that renunciation without understanding the principal element of attraction to Krishna, that's also not important. That it means one should take it seriously as part of the process. The process is chanting and developing one's attraction to Krishna. But the giving up of the attachments and distractions of this world is part of the process in sadhana bhakti. Right? So if that's accepted, then the purity will come. The purity comes, then the form of the Lord becomes revealed. Yes?
I find it's interesting, Maharaj, because in Sanskrit we use pratyahara for retraction.
Yeah, pratyahara just means pulling out. Because that's what we're saying. Retraction means that. Because he said renunciation in the beginning, but after that, all the other sutras is using the word retraction. Because retraction just means you're pulling back from engaging the senses. Right? So for us, that means, since the senses will always be engaged, that's the meaning of the living entity, is that it means it's being pulled back from illusory engagement and being engaged in positive engagement. You know what I'm saying? So either direct activities, you're pulling out of material activities and applying into direct, or you're dovetailing the material in the Lord's service. So one or the other is going on. Like that. So retraction is quite, so that's the yogic term. Yeah. But it means that you're retracting from some place, you know, that they've gone out to. So if you're retracting back from material, where does that leave it once it's been fully retracted? Right? On the spiritual platform. That's the difference. We say renunciation, we take it, I'm from here, and I'm renouncing here. And then, so once I renounce, then what? So then it becomes the dry asceticism. But the concept of retraction is, you're only giving up that which you're not supposed to be doing. Right? Renunciation gives you the idea that
you could be doing this, but you choose not to. As opposed to, it's not actually what you're supposed to be doing. It's not the nature. Right? So you're retracting out of the, pulling oneself out of the material consciousness. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, end of chapter 4 of Sri Tattva Sutra. A summary of chapter 4. Chapter 4 of Sri Tattva Sutra pertains to the fourth topic of the Upanishads, the means of attaining Brahman. Right? So he's been showing this balance between attraction to Krishna and renunciation. Right? The nature of the soul, nature of Godhead, the nature of the material world, and you know what's that? All that relationship together is being applied into practical, that you engage directly in activities that uplift us to Krishna consciousness, and we give up those activities that pertain to the material world. Right? Bhakti is unalloyed full attachment to Krishna, the transcendental Lord. According to the situation of the living entities, conditioned or liberated, devotional service is also understood to be in two stages, phala and fruition, and upaya, means, regulated. So liberated, that's phala bhakti. Conditioned, that's upaya bhakti. Spontaneous love of God is independent, unalloyed, and constitutionally the nature of the living entity, and therefore does not have any other limbs. Right? So that spontaneous love. So when that spontaneous love is not naturally manifest, then you create the environment of practice of regulating that so that it comes out. Does that make sense? We won't spontaneously engage in it, so therefore there's a regulated process that allows it to manifest. So that's why it's upaya bhakti. It's natural that it will be here, phala bhakti. But because it's not, therefore the upaya brings that element out. Right? So it's the same thing. That's what has to be seen. It's not two different processes. The one is just naturally manifest, the other it's not. So therefore, you do that which will make the same thing manifest. Cultivation of favorable devotion and retraction from sense gratificatory activities are the two limbs of regulated devotion. The nine processes of devotional service, beginning with hearing and chanting, are the means by which one can develop such favorable conditional love for Krishna. Right, so you're regulating the life so that retraction is on a regular basis, so that you're, even though you'd like to be doing more, you're doing less. And then the regulated devotional service means you're engaged in doing the nine processes of devotional service more, which you'd probably like to be doing less. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the upaya means you're striking that balance, that though that which you would like to do, which is material, you're controlling, and that which you wouldn't want to do because it's spiritual, you're actually in doing. Right? So then slowly then it moves forward. So as it goes, as given, the example is given of the patient with jaundice, the sugar is not sweet. While the sicker you are, it means if you're really sick, it'll taste bitter. Right? But if you're not so sick, it'll just, you eat it and it's like, it's neutral. There's no taste at all. Even water has more taste. Right? It's neutral. But as you keep going, the effect will be there. Your health will start to come. Then you start to get a little bit of taste. And so then when you taste it, it's very sweet, then you know. Does that make sense? So like that, is that that which you don't want to do, you're doing, and that which you want to do, you're restricting. Right? You know. The body is the chariot. The mind is the charioteer. The senses are the horses. Driving this chariot back home towards Krishna consciousness from the path of sense gratification by the help of transcendental knowledge and proper engagement of everything in devotional service is known as pratyahara, retraction. Right? So here's the definition of retraction. Right? Because you've situated yourself in Krishna consciousness. Right? So yama niyama is present. You know, you know what to do, what not to do. You situate yourself, so asana is there. Now the next thing is pratyahara. Pulling the senses back. Right? Because when that's pulled back, then there can be dharma, focus. Right? And then dhyana and samadhi.
Okay, yeah. Body is the chariot, I mean, because it's being driven by the mind. And the senses are the horses, so the mind is also the charioteer because it's driving the horses. So it controls the body by driving the horses. So if the mind is engaging the senses in devotional activities, you go back to Godhead. If it's engaging in material activities, you're going the other way on the singular path. Right? And so one end is Golok, the other end is hell. So we'll leave the math up to
wherever
you
want to go.
Yeah. Wherever you want to go in either of these two directions, you know, I mean, or on the same, on the one path, right? This idea, do whatever you want to do. Yeah, you're free. No, you're not. You know, you want to listen all day, but if you don't plug it in, it dies, you know, so therefore you're not free. Plus, you have to pay the bill. Right?
Well, you're free to not pay the bill, and then there are consequences.
Yes. And now you're getting philosophical.
I thought
that may not go. That may not go down as commercial. Pay the bill, or the consequences. Right?
No.
Okay. Transcendental knowledge is the cause of liberation, and mundane materialistic knowledge is the cause of bondage. Right. There's no ifs, ands, or buts on this. It's just the way it is. Now, if that materialistic knowledge is somehow or another dovetailed in the Lord's service, then there won't be any problem. But because it's dovetailed, but just that you have it, and just that you're applying it, does not infer that it's not binding. You know what I'm saying? We make the mistake, because I'm a devotee, therefore the material knowledge is also devotional. No, it's still just as binding. You know what I'm saying? The knife cuts whether you're a devotee or not. It's the same. It doesn't change. Right? So what changes is the consciousness, then how it's engaged. But still, it'll be indirect. Right? So even if it's engaged in the Lord's service, the material knowledge is still not going to be on the same status as spiritual knowledge. Right? It's the supreme knowledge.
And in the process of engaging it, there are traps of...
Yeah, of course. Engaging is there's traps. Because the point is how you're going to engage it. You can technically engage it in occupation. Right? So that'll create facilities for ashram. Now what are you going to do with it?
Try to enjoy it.
Yeah, so that's the problem. Is material knowledge is not going to show you how ashram works. There is no institution in the world that shows you how ashram works. Right? Right? There's institutions that will give you qualifications for occupation, but not ashram. So that's the thing, is that, okay, great, you have now what? So that's the point. Okay, now you can go out. Now you can get money. Now you can have a house and facility. Now what? So now you can be like everybody else. They have money, they have facility, but they don't have any family life considered worth talking about. Right? They're unhappy, they're miserable. Right? So then what is it? It's a trick. I'm miserable. Why shouldn't you be miserable? Right?
It's easier to be miserable when everybody else is.
Yeah, if everybody else is miserable, hey, it makes life easier.
Everybody is
right?
Very miserable. Miserable is key.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Because right? Then you can be the victim, right? So the idea is that it will bind. But if you see it in connection to Krishna, then only it won't have that binding effect. But it still should not be considered equal to devotional knowledge. Like that. You know, just like renunciation is very important, but it's never equal to the direct devotional activities. Engagement of everything in Krishna's service is the cause of liberation, and pseudo-renunciation is the cause of bondage. So even you're taking this materialistic knowledge and you're using it in Krishna's service, then it will be the cause of liberation. Right? Like that. But not devotion. You understand? It's you're doing something for Krishna that causes the devotion, not the activity itself. Otherwise, then devotion, then there's a limb of bhakti,
It's not independent. You perform the activity, therefore you get the bhakti. Like that. Pseudo renunciation, where you just say, you know, don't worry about it, or this or that, all these little things, that then it will be further bondage.
Yes. Pseudo renunciation, could that also be like laziness when it comes to doing your duty or something?
Laziness. Well, here generally pseudo would mean that it appears like renunciation, but it's not necessarily. You know what I'm saying?
Externally it allows, but internally.
Yeah, it means you wouldn't have given the money to the temple anyway. Mm. You know, you had plans this year, this big thing. You went to put the extension on your house. You know, you're going to go for that vacation. You know, all these different things like that. You know, kids' education is coming up. But then the IRS comes along and says there's a problem here and you have too much money. Mm. And so they're going to take it. So then you find out that you can give in charity and all that. So then you come to the temple with all devotion and all that and say, here, this is there because of, you know, it's just you're doing such great work and all that. So though it's devotional service, but the idea that you're renouncing and giving that pseudo. Mm. You're making a... It's called Dharmadvaja. You're showing the flag of renunciation of religion, but it's not actually. But because you are giving the temple, you'll get the spiritual benefit. Right? But you don't really get the benefit for renouncing. No, you will on some level. Krishna will give it to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But not as much as if you had done it willingly. You know what I'm saying?
Probably harder than if you had done it willingly.
Yeah. If one is not fully free from sense gratification, the cultivation of devotional practices will not award transcendental love for Krishna, although there will be no downfall. Right? So one will be situated, but won't give love of God. That's the point. To the extent of freedom from sense gratification, one can perform pure regulated devotional service, which turns into bhava bhakti, which will ultimately bloom into love for Krishna. Right? So, one's attached to sense gratification. If one's engaging it, then one will be purified. But until there's the element of service to Krishna, I mean that devotion to Krishna within it, then it's not going to take on that positive, right? Because the attachment is still to the sense gratification, rather than one's performing those activities as duties. In other words, the area where your sense gratification is found are the same areas that would be your duties. But you can see it from the results for Krishna or the results for yourself. Right? So that degree is for Krishna, then there's no problem. That degree is for yourself, that will get in the way. Right? Or it may be two different things. One's doing nicely in some areas of devotional service, in some areas one's attached to sense gratification. So that the same point is going to be there. It'll create a neutral situation. Does that make sense? So the focus is not enough on the direct devotional that it's pulling one forward, one's becoming renounced. At the same time, the elements of the renunciation are not lacking to the degree where one's totally absorbed in. Right? But even there, it even says that even if one does become totally distracted, that the one will still then appear in families that will be favorable for Krishna consciousness, right? Because the Brahman means here we can have the overlap from not very advanced, where it's just they're not necessarily devotees, they're just pious people. So Brahminical, they're pious, they follow rules, so that'll be very easy to take up a Krishna conscious lifestyle, right? If you grew up in a Brahman family where your whole life you've washed your hands, mouth, and feet after eating, going to the toilet, that, everything's clean, everything's regulated, everyone has time in a day, you get up early, you go to bed. It won't be hard to be living in the temple. It's the same lifestyle. You've just added Krishna. Right? But now, let's say that family's a devotee family, then that will be even better. Or it can be, they're wealthy, so you have facilities, so that means you have plenty of idle time, right? That's where the rich kids get into trouble, because they have nothing to do. Now, you could be chanting Hare Krishna, going to the temple and that, right? While not being in the rich family, you have to go out, get a job, do all the different things, so you don't have that time. So that's the advantage. Or it could be, it's a devotee family, and they have facilities and money. You know what I'm saying? So it could be anything in between. You know what I'm saying? Depending upon one's consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not lost in any case, devotional service. It's always... Okay, part three, Prayojana. Topic five, the nature of the supreme goal and the status of the jiva and mukti, right? Because you have the goal, but you also have to know what's the status of the jiva having reached that goal. Does that make sense? Because the goal means you're liberated from some situation. So there's you're in the situation, that's the facts. Then there's a process to elevate you out of that situation and get you to what your goal is. But you have to know what's the situation of the jiva on that platform. It's part of the discussion. So when someone says, yes, we want to, you know, go back to the kingdom of God and all that, sounds great. But it says, what will be the position of the jiva in that? What is your relationship with Godhead? Right? Oh, he's the guy out at the door. It wasn't he was the big guy out at the door, right? You know, the big armchair, and he kind of points this way or that way, and like that. You can't see his face anyway, so I don't know what's the big deal, right? You know, but you just walk around his chair, and hey, here we are, great time. You know? You understand? So then you understand is that really God conscious, right? So in other words, they understood God was in control or is in control. Well, I mean, at that stage, once you change perspective, it was in control, right? You know, but you have the material facility, and so it's his kingdom. You follow his laws, you get rewarded. But the reward isn't love for him and interaction with him. You understand? Some may talk about it, but others, it's just you go and you're in a heavenly situation. You'll enjoy yourself. You know? Does that make sense? So, therefore, then what they're talking about isn't actually spiritual. Right? Because it's not the soul and relating with God. Right? So then you can see actually the process. Then you understand this is a process of karma. Right? But you're recognizing God, as opposed to just doing good work and being elevated to the heavenly planet. Here, you're seeing God's, you know, favor to get to the heavenly planets. You understand? So it's a God-conscious form of karma. Does that make sense? But we see in all these schools, the Vedic schools, there's a recognition that God is there and he's controlling everything, so you have to follow his laws. Right, but the end result is not—it's not nothing to do with God. In a sense, so it's not an uncommon. In other words, the end results of material endeavor basically always end up the same way. Right, you either have some good, nice facilities, or there'll be nothingness. You know, one or the other. You know, it's like that.
No.
Most are looking at that side. Though you do hear some people talk about love of God, if you use the terms, then no one coming basically from your Abrahamic traditions will have any problem with it. But if you actually look very carefully, it's not technically about God. Yeah, it's more about enjoying life, you know, going to heaven or having heaven descend here, you know. Then you don't have to go as far, right? Save on bus tickets or something. Yes.
How purification must happen?
How purification is happening to them?
In India, more or less, you worship demigods if you want some material facility, but in the Christian tradition, you worship God.
No, but that's a different discussion. See, means, in other words, you started discussing the example as opposed to the point the example is making. You understand? The example is to show that it's important to know the status of the jiva when he's come to his goal. right? Means that discussion you're talking about, that will be next year's, because then we'll go through all philosophies, world religions, and everything like that. Does that make sense? So the point is that one must know that, because if someone says something, ask them what's going to be the position. That's where you start to see the major differences. Because in general concept of goal, there's not necessarily much difference. Right? You want to get out of this, you know, mundane situation into something considered less mundane. But then, depending upon what that is, the position of the jiva, then you start to see that it's actually just a more refined mundane, less problematic mundane. It's not actually transcendental. You understand? That's what we're dealing with right here. Like that. Those will be details. We'll get into that later. Okay. So this is mantra 6, 7, 10, 12, and 13. He who sees systematically everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything nor any being. One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? That's mantra 6 and 7. So here, see, systematically means according to how the Shastras present it. He doesn't make it up. He sees as the Shastras present it. So that means everything's in relation to the Lord. Everything is the Lord. The living entities are parts and parcels of the Lord. Right? So this way, he doesn't hate anything because everything's connected to the Lord. And he actually is a true knower. Right? So there's no negative. And the positive there is he actually has knowledge. So then they're rightfully situated. So that when it says hates anything or any being, so that means there is nothing. Right? It doesn't mean he's in ecstasy when he sees this and that. That's mundane concept. He's seeing the Lord like that. So it's not the external element that's important. Right? He's seeing the Lord, he's seeing the jivas. And everything else is just situation. Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Mantra 6. Above, the Madhyamadhikari is the Uttamadhikari, who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord. As part and parcel, such a devotee does not discriminate between an atheist and a theist, but sees everyone as part and parcel of God. That's why we see example of when these Uttamadhikaris, when they talk to a living entity, doesn't matter who he is, because generally they either have talking to a very qualified person who understands their position, and then therefore ask very good questions. Or they have him talking to somebody who he would generally consider less than ordinary. You know? Like that. And so then we see the effect, that because they don't see the difference in relationship, naturally the other person responds on how they're dealt with. You know what I'm saying? So if you deal with them, you know, as part and parcel of the Lord, so therefore they're friend because they're all part of the Lord's family, they respond very differently. So it's not a technique, right? So it's not that, okay, Prahlad Maharaj said these things and I go out and find the guy and say these things. You know, if it works, great. But if it doesn't work, then it's because of how he sees, and people can pick up on that. Right? They can tell how you're dealing, right? But at the same time, they understand it's not mundane, it's something else. So therefore, they don't apply the same concepts of mundanity to it, right? And try to take advantage or anything. So it's just very different. He knows that there's no essential difference between a vastly learned Brahmin and a dog in the street, because both of them are part and parcel of the Lord. Although they are encased in different bodies on account of the different qualities of their activities in their previous lives. That's where you tell the difference. There's no difference in the souls, but because of their previous activities, then they're encaged differently. So you deal with the cage differently. Right? You know, we'll take it. No, but he'll make no distinction. But then that means no distinction means no intelligence. But he is the most he is the true knower of things. So therefore, he doesn't have any bad feelings for, you know, the dog, and good feelings. only for the Brahman. He sees them all equally. But because the Brahman is encaged in that way, you can deal with him on that Brahminical platform and he'll take advantage. Well, the dog being caged how he is, then you have to deal with him according to his dogness, right? So feed him prasad, stuff like that, that's nice. As we mentioned before, forget the philosophy. Right? That's generally not very appreciated. Right? Does that make sense? He sees that the Brahmana particle of the Supreme Lord has not misused his little independence given him by the Lord, and that the dog particle has misused his independence and is therefore being punished by the laws of nature by being encaged in the form of a dog. Not considering the respective actions of the Brahman and the dog, Uttamadikari tries to do good to both. Right? It's not that because he did bad, therefore, you know, we'll leave him alone, and the Brahman, he's done good, therefore he gets the gold star. Right? You know, but it's that whatever you can do for either of them, you do. Right? But the dog is a dog, so you know, it's not that you take him in the house and sit him down in front of the altar and, you know, hand him a japa beads and, you know, like that. And, you know.
Good doggy.
Yeah, good doggy. Make sure you don't touch your front rear end. Yeah, so. Such a learned devotee is not misled by material bodies, but is attracted by the spiritual spark within them. So he's not misled. I mean, somebody takes the dog as their friend, man's best friend, all these different things. How come it's not a woman's best friend? Whatever, man's best friend. And so then everything like that, and then it goes on. But that's misled because it's not your best friend. Right? Krishna and the devotees are your best friends. One's misled. One thinks one will get something from here. I will become happy. You know, I will be, you know, enriched. But the problem is the dog lives 10 to 12 years, you live 100. So then you're going to be disappointed. The dog will leave. Right? You know, the dog doesn't always do what you want. You know? Does that make sense? You know, so one is misled. Well, the pure devotee then here isn't misled because he knows what the body is, how the reaction has gotten, so therefore what it does. So you deal accordingly. Right? So the dog stays outside, the Brahman you abide inside. Right? Both get prasad. Right. In the purport to Mantra 13, it is stated, when one attains brahminical qualifications, he becomes happy and enthusiastic to render devotional service to the Lord. Right? Because the mode of goodness, naturally, one comes up. One is automatically, the science of God is unveiled before him. By knowing the science of God, one gradually becomes free from material attachments. And one's doubtful and mind becomes crystal clear by the grace of the Lord. One who attains this stage is a liberated soul who can see the Lord in every step of life. This is the perfection of Sambhava, as described in this mantra of Sri Ishopanishad. Yeah, so it's showing that the mode of goodness and all that then is valuable, right? But we don't attempt for it separately, like we don't attempt for renunciation separately. It's part of the process, right? Because in knowledge, then you live the lifestyle of knowledge, which is the mode of goodness. In Dasamul Tattva, the nature of the supreme goal is presented as follows. 10. Pure love of Krishna is the living entity's ultimate goal. Chapter 5 of Tattva Sutra. Siddhanta Prakarana, the final conclusion. Sutra 41. Yana suryasya hi rasmaya shastrani. Revealed scriptures are the rays of the sun of divine knowledge. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura's commentary. The divine knowledge is compared to the sun, and all the scriptures are the rays of that sun. The God-given self-evident knowledge of the jivas is the source of all the scriptures. The sages have received the self-evident knowledge from the Supreme Lord and recorded it for the benefit of the jivas. This recorded portion of this primeval knowledge has been manifest in the form of the Vedas. The Vedic teachings, so this knowledge is there, it's eternal. So it's the sages who then have it documented. Right? So the knowledge that they hear, you know, in its original form, that's the Veda itself. Right? And then that knowledge of which they discuss amongst themselves for furthering their understanding and practice of the Veda, that becomes the Smriti. Right? Yes.
How exactly the Vedas are eternal?
How exactly are the Vedas eternal? What do you mean by exactly?
Every kalpa, the same word to word?
The same word to word. What if it uses a synonym? Would you be disturbed? What if it puts one chapter before another? Would you feel bad?
I don't mind.
You don't mind. Okay, good. Very broad-minded here. Very. Okay. So, the point is it's a body of knowledge about the Supreme Lord. So, that's technically unlimited. But there are certain verses that are always the essential points from which this unlimited expands. Right? So that's the Veda. It's always there. Right? So, means they're using it in the spiritual world also. So it's just, it will be manifested here, but it's eternal. You know? So it's not like the material energy that's only manifest due to the interaction and desires of the living entity. This is the way it is. When Garuda flaps his wings, the sound that comes from the feathers is the Samaveda. You know? So these things, they're always there. Right? Vyasadeva in Kali Yuga compiles them so you get these four Vedas. But all those four Vedas are four aspects of one Veda. Like that. Does that make sense? Okay.
So is the Vedas revealed according to the need of that specific creation?
Are the Vedas revealed according to the specific need of the creation? Basically, is the Vedas, it's always the same thing. I mean, because you're not dealing with that many verses. Samaveda is, I think, 12 or 1300 verses only. Rig, I think, is 10,000. Atharva, I think, is 8. Yajur is about 8. Atharva is about 5 or 6,000. So you're not talking about that many verses, but those verses are from those everything else is expanding. Right? The Veda is an expansion of the Brahma Gayatri. Right? The Brahma Gayatri is an expansion of the Bhurbhuva Swa, which is expanding from Om. Om is expanding from the Kama Gayatri, which is expanding from the Hare Krishna Mahamantra. So it's eternal. Purusha Shukta is in between the Brahma Gayatri and the full Veda. Yes.
You've just come from Madagascar last week with our Maharaj. So my question is, if this Vyas Gufa, is this can we accept this as a place where Vyasadeva wrote the Vedas, or is this more for the Lord?
No, it'd be where he compiled. If they say that's where he compiled them, then that's where he compiled them. Because the point is the four Vedas are there, but they're generally dealt with as one Veda. So someone would study the whole Veda. But then that takes much longer time, right? And all the different aspects. So if you break it up into four, it makes it much more clear for a particular living, a conditioned living entity. So that's where he would compile the Vedas. Does that make sense? So he's only compiling what's already there. Like that. Yeah, no, so it's not folklore. Just like that, there's that little place on the Vrindavan Parikram. When you come around the back, when you turn back in towards our place, where he sat and wrote 10th canto. Like that. So These things are real.
Are the Vedas the expansion of the chit potency of the Lord?
Are the Vedas the expansion of the chit potency? Basically, they're knowledge of the Lord, but they're such that they can carry the chit potency or not, depending upon how you approach them.
Are those personalities that the Veda, the personalities of the Veda that sit in the Brahma's court, are they like a jiva?
The Vedas that are sitting in Brahma's court, are they like jivas? What do you mean, like jivas?
Are they the jivas or...
are they the jivas?
The jivas.
If they're the jivas, then what kind of... what are you? If they're the jivas, then... means whether they're jivas or not, still the post is the same. They still have that same understanding, the same knowledge. You know, so whether they're directly just... whether they're directly Lord's potencies other than jivas, or whether they're jivas, it doesn't matter. They're still the Lord's potency. Does that make sense?
In the Vedas, Maharaj, it seems that a great deal of the information is about, you know, the demigods and things like that.
A great deal of information is about the demigods, but the point is what is the potency of that demigod? Yeah, so then that's what they're describing. You're in the material world. Purusha Shukta is what? Purusha Shukta is defining the primary creation. That the Lord is there with the primeval sages. Then, because there's nothing manifest then, and you can only manifest things through action, which means sacrifice. So then they arrange a sacrifice where the Lord is being used as sacrifice, because there is nothing else other than the Lord. Right? So him being engaged in the sacrifice, as soon as they begin the sacrifice, then the Lord divides into all the different things, you know, or expands into all the different things of the world in the primary creation. So all the species of life, all the situations, all the different things that cause omens and anything else, the elements of action, the results of action, everything like that.
That's on the blueprint, though.
Yes. So then the Vedas will be described, they expand from there, so they'll be describing it within both the primeval and the secondary.
Well, you said that it's used in the spiritual world as well.
It's used in this, what do you think? What do you think the yogic Brahmins are chanting in the morning in Braj? So they'll be chanting Vedic. In other words, why are they the yogic Brahmins? Yogic Brahmins use Vedas. Okay? They're not using Chaucer or, you know, the Iliad or Beowulf or something.
But they have concepts of the gods in the spiritual world. Like when they perform sacrifice, do they have, you know, various rituals for intermediary authorities?
Have you heard of the Govardhan Leela?
Yeah.
And,
but that's in Gopur.
Is there a difference? What's the difference? Go cool and go low. What's the difference?
Well, they say there's five things. In the one, there are demons.
There are demons.
Yeah. I think the Goswami is this five different demons. Demons are there.
So does it mention that there are no demigods?
I don't know, that's why I'm asking.
So the Govardhan Leela, so they have a concept. Why would the same person, when he's here, have a concept of demigods, and when he's in Goloka, wouldn't have? You know what I'm saying? If it goes by that, was Bhagavad Gita spoken Like before the Vrindavan pastimes or after the Vrindavan pastimes? So the Dwarka pastimes, Bhagavad Gita. After. It's on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, right? Right? So that means when Krishna's like 125, right? Okay. But Nanda Baba is talking about Bhagavad Gita in Vrindavan.
Some point out that this is only Srila Prabhupada's translation of the Bhagavatam verse in
Shastra. The time when they point those things out, you have a few options. One is leave. Two is cut out their tongue. Three is kill yourself. Right? These are basically your options. This is called people who are so intelligent that they qualify themselves for hell. Right? The Mayavadis are very intelligent. You know? As a class, they would be considered good academics. But they're going for the darkest regions, beyond that of the gross sensual hedonists. So therefore, people like that, don't even bother associating with them. You can just like strike them off your list. You know, since when does this Malecha or Yavana by background suddenly now know more about the scriptures and Sanskrit than Prabhupada does? Go ahead, knock me out. You know, what little book did they buy on the shelf in a bookshop about some kind of college grammar that they picked up a few words and everything like that? Prabhupada could translate Vedic Sanskrit. In our society, only Bhanu Maharaj can do that. There is no one else, and I mean no one else, without an exception. So that means what he knew in grammar and what he knew in philosophy was so far beyond what these persons, these small-minded, miserly persons who think themselves so intelligent are. So it's not a matter of, now it's, you know, free, everybody can speak. No, it's just these kind of persons either stop talking like that or you stop associating. You know what I'm saying? They're nonsense. That's all. They have no idea. They can look in a dictionary because Monier Williams, which was a British person whose actual purpose in writing all that down was to make a farce out of Indian religion and philosophy, and they take him as the authority. And then they'll use that against Prabhupada. Now you tell me that's a disciple. You tell me that that has any spiritual validity. You tell me that even on the mundane platform, that's called loyalty. So, this is what he's talking about when people are being overly intelligent. Right? But we try to keep it nice and pleasant. Right? And try to avoid these things. But, persons like that are fit to be rejected. Manu says that. Anybody like that, you should not eat with them, you should not deal with them, you should not marry into their families, you should have zero to do with them. That's what Manu says. Because such persons, it's better, as Lord Chaitanya said, to be in a cage with a tiger than to be sitting with these persons. Because up to them, they'll destroy one's faith in Prabhupada and try to establish that they know more Sanskrit than Prabhupada. As Prabhupada would say, we kick on their face. And you can take that either we will put our foot in their face or we will kick them so that they fall on their face. Either way. We're not being...
Stick
on
that.
Yeah, we're not for that.
This one, we could
Oh, with boots. Okay, so maybe it's more with a... Now, is that bobber boots?
Doesn't specify.
Probably good. With hobnails.
You can use a good old Bengali technique on the chapan hand.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's also that. You understand? So the point is these things don't apply. They don't understand what they're talking about. Because generally those who discuss these things only read grammar, nyaya, logic, those things like that. They never read the Acharya's works on what happens in the eternal pastime. And the ones who read the eternal pastime never read the grammar and nyaya and all those different things like that. So therefore you have these two seeming different things going at each other's throat. But the point is the Acharyas know both. That's why they can talk in either side. Like that. So, you know. It doesn't work well for an individual's devotional service to take that status. I mean, God brothers that I've known that have taken that status, they've not done very well.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki
Jai
Jainidai Gauru
Hare Gauru.